From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As an African in America, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie didn't initially understand what life is like for African Americans. Race wasn't a big part of her identity growing up in Nigeria.
I really didn't consciously think of myself as black because I didn't have to. I thought of myself as Igbo, which is my ethnicity.
Today we talk with her about her new novel, Americana, which is based on her experiences coming to America to attend college and finding herself in the middle of conversations about race in a coded language she didn't yet understand, even a conversation about watermelon.
Race is such a strange construct because you have to learn what it means to be black in America. So you have to learn that watermelon is supposed to be offensive.
Also, David Edelstein reviews new movies from Pedro Almodovar and Neil Jordan. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Being an African in America doesn't necessarily mean you know what it's like to be an African American. That's one of the things my guest learned when she came to the U.S. from Nigeria to attend college. She found white and black people projecting things on her she didn't understand, and she was confused by the coded language that was often used to talk about race. She didn't get it, but eventually she did. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie has written a new novel based on her experiences coming to America called Americana. Her main character writes a blog called Race Teenth, or Various Observations About American Blacks, those formerly known as Negroes, by a non-American black. Our book critic describes the novel as a big knockout of a novel about immigration, American dreams, the power of first love, and the shifting meanings of skin color. One of Adichie's earlier novels, Half of a Yellow Sun, about the Biafran War, was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Later, we'll talk about the devastating effect of that war on her family. Chimamanda Adichie, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from your book, and since your character blogs a lot, let's start with one of her blog posts. So if you could read the title of the post and the post.
So this post is titled, To My Fellow Non-American Blacks, In America, You Are Black, Baby. Dear non-American black, when you make the choice to come to America, you become black. Stop arguing. Stop saying, I'm Jamaican or I'm Ghanaian. America doesn't care. So what if you weren't black in your country? You're in America now. We all have our moments of initiation into the society of former Negroes. Mine was in a class in undergrad when I was asked to give the black perspective, only I had no idea what that was. So I just made something up. And admit it, you say, I'm not black, only because you know black is at the bottom of America's race ladder. And you want none of that. Don't deny now. What if being black had all the privileges of being white? Would you still say, don't call me black, I'm from Trinidad? I didn't think so. So, you're black, baby. And here's the deal with becoming black. You must show that you are offended when such words as watermelon or tar baby are used in jokes, even if you don't know what the hell is being talked about. And since you are a non-American black, the chances are that you won't know. In undergrad, a white classmate asks if I like watermelon. I say yes. And another classmate says, oh my God, that is so racist. And I'm confused. Wait, how? You must nod back when a black person nods at you in a heavily white area. It is called the black nod. It is a way for black people to say, you're not alone, I'm here too. In describing black women you admire, always use the word strong, because that is what black women are supposed to be in America. If you're a woman, please do not speak your mind, as you're used to doing in your country. Because in America, strong-minded black women are scary. And if you're a man, be hyper-mellow. Never get too excited or somebody will worry that you're about to pull a gun. When you watch television and hear that a racist slur was used, you must immediately become offended. Even though you're thinking, but why won't they tell me exactly what was said? Even though you would like to be able to decide for yourself how offended to be, or whether to be offended at all, you must nevertheless be very offended.
And that's a reading from Chimamanda Adichie's new book, Americana. So it's a great passage. You weren't defined by race when you were in Nigeria. Everyone around you was black. So how did things change when you were seen as black after coming to America? And knowing here that you were defined by race, that race is the big divide in America.
I think for me, I like to think of it as something of a journey for me. I remember when I first came to the U.S., I really didn't consciously think of myself as black because I didn't have to. I thought of myself as Igbo, which is my ethnicity. And then in the U.S., there was a moment when I had just arrived and I was in Brooklyn, and this African-American man called me sister. And I remember reacting almost viscerally and thinking, no, I am not your sister. And And then I think also at the time I had very quickly absorbed all the negative stereotypes of blackness in America. And so I didn't want to associate myself with that. And I also remember in undergrad when a professor of mine came into class and said, "Who is Adichie?" Because this person called Adichie, which is the way Americans often pronounce my last name, had written the best essay in class. And I remember raising my hand, and for a fleeting moment, there was surprise on his face. And I realized that the person who wrote the best essay wasn't supposed to look like me.
Do you feel like assumptions change about you when a white person or a black person finds out that you're from Nigeria and not born in the U.S.?
Yes, yes. I think that when I open my mouth and talk, and obviously everybody knows I don't have an American accent, in general, I have been told such things as, "You're different," or "You're not angry," or "You don't have issues," that sort of thing. So there's sort of the assumption. I think there's a kind of, it's a strange thing and it's complicated, but there's a certain privilege to not being African-American in certain circles in the U.S., being black but not African-American.
What is the privilege, and why do you think there is a sense of privilege?
I think that one isn't burdened by America's terrible racial history. And I think that when people say to me, "You're different and you're not angry," in some ways, it's that I also feel that I'm being made complicit in something that I don't want to be complicit in, because in some ways they're saying you're one of the good ones, and I think to say that is to somehow ignore, you know, the reality of American history. And so, for example, people will say, "Oh, you're so easy to get along with," and then they'll tell me a story about some African American woman they knew who just wasn't like me, and you know, which I find quite absurd, but. But yes, I think the honest, if we're honest about it, there's a certain privilege to being black but not African American.
I think for white people too, there's this burden of guilt that's lifted, because I think there is a sense of kind of collective guilt that white people carry for enslaving African Americans. And so, if your ancestors were never brought to the U.S. and enslaved, poof, in this relationship, you're relieved of that guilt.
Yeah. I think that is true. I mean, I think that the part of my life where I feel that guilt, because I feel a certain amount of class guilt. I think I occupy a space of privilege when it comes to class. And I know, for example, that when I'm back in Nigeria, I feel class guilt. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I do think it can get in the way of honest conversations. So I realize that there's white guilt in the U.S., but I don't think it's very helpful. I don't know if that makes sense. I mean, I think that maybe what American blacks and American whites should take away from the table is the idea of personal responsibility.
What do you mean by personal responsibility?
I think that sometimes white Americans think that, to start off, they say things like, "Well, it's not my fault. I didn't do anything." And I just feel like, of course it isn't your fault, right? It's not... But the fact that white Americans benefit from a history that gives them white privilege doesn't mean that it's somehow their fault. They didn't ask to be born white. I mean, so in the novel, for example, Ifemelu, who's the main character, goes to work for a white woman. And this white woman is very well-meaning, and she just is so uncomfortable about race that she won't say black. So if she wants to talk about black people, she says beautiful. So she'll say to Ifemelu, "Oh, I'm going to go see my beautiful co-worker. Or I have this beautiful woman that I met at the store." And it turned out that every time Ifemelu actually did end up seeing these people, they were not particularly beautiful, but they were just black. And so Ifemelu says to her, "You know, you can actually just say black." And for Ifemelu, it's the beginning of a friendship. That's the point where she imagines that this woman is her friend, because that's for her when she thinks that they can actually talk honestly about things. Because, you know, not all black people are beautiful, and so it's actually okay to say black.
In the blog post reading that your character does from your novel Americana, your main character, who's Nigerian after coming to America, finds herself in the middle of these like landmines about language and stuff that she doesn't really understand, because she's not schooled in America's race conflicts. Did that happen to you? Did you find yourself in the middle of conversations where you didn't really understand the subtext, so you had no idea why somebody was angry or how you were supposed to respond?
Yes. I did initially. I mean, now, of course, having read quite a bit about African-American history, and I know now, but initially I didn't. And I remember, for example, and I use this in the book, a conversation in my undergrad class about watermelon. And an African-American classmate was very annoyed because she said that somebody else in class had said something to her about watermelons. And I remember sitting there thinking, but what's so bad about watermelons? Because I quite like watermelons. And just really being confused and also feeling that the African-American woman was annoyed with me because she thought I should get it and that I should share in her rage. And because I didn't quite understand that this watermelon comment was supposed to be racist, I couldn't share in her rage. And so I just was sort of confused. And it was such a strange moment because looking back now, I realize it's how one learns. I mean, that race is such a strange construct because you have to learn what it means to be Black in America. So you have to learn that watermelon is supposed to be offensive.
So much of America's history and America's racial tensions have to do with slavery. You really can't understand America without understanding the history of slavery in America. And you're from Nigeria, which was the place that a lot of Africans were kidnapped from, so as to be taken to the United States to become slaves. And I'm wondering, like, was the slave trade a part of what you learned about in school when you were growing up?
Mm-mm. Not really, no. I really don't think that in general, and of course I'm generalizing, but I don't think there's a very strong sense of the magnitude and the horror that the transatlantic slave trade was for people of my generation in Nigeria, and I'm probably going to say in most of the African continent. I don't really remember learning very much about slavery when I was in school, and which I think is also why many Nigerians don't really get it, to put it simply, no.
My guest is Chimamanda Adichie, author of the new novel Americana. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Chimamanda Adichie, and she's the author of the new novel Americana, which is about a young Nigerian woman who comes to the United States to study. What brought you to America to study? Why did you want to come here?
I was supposed to be a doctor in Nigeria, so I had started studying medicine. I did well in school. When you do well in school, they tell you you have to be a doctor. And I did that for a year and a half, and I was very unhappy. And my sister, who had been born here when my father got his PhD in statistics at Berkeley, and my sister had been born here in the 60s. So she was a dual citizen, American and Nigerian, and she'd come here. And I suddenly thought, you know, somebody's in America who will give me a bed and give me food. And so I took the SATs, and I was almost certain that I would get a scholarship so I could escape the study of medicine. So that's really it. And partly also because leaving medicine in Nigeria would have meant going on to do another thing that was in the sciences, and I was so tired of science.
Wait, why couldn't you stay in Nigeria and major in literature?
Because you can't move from... There's something called the science track. So I had been in the science track from my fourth year in secondary school. And again, there are assumptions about subjects of study. So if you do well in school, they tell you you have to be in the sciences. And I had taken my exams in the junior secondary, got the best results, and I really wanted to study literature and history. And they said to me, oh, no, you have to be in the biology and the chemistry and the physics. And so that's already a track. And so the exam that you take to get into university, you do the sciences. And so to change, you just can't change. I would have to go and start over. And I just wasn't prepared to do that, to take the entrance exams again. And also I hadn't been prepared in what they call the arts, so I just couldn't. And so really for me, America became escape. And just really because my sister was here, I had the choice of I had the choice of that escape. So I took the SATs, got a scholarship, and I escaped the study of medicine.
That's so interesting because so many people come to America to escape war or poverty or, an arranged marriage or something like that. You come to escape having to be a science major.
Yes, we all have our problems, don't we?
When you came to America, did you expect, I'll get my degree or my degrees and then return?
It was very vague. I was just so pleased to have escaped, really, the sciences. And I loved my classes. I really do love the American liberal arts college education system, and the way that you can take class. I took classes in philosophy and in political science and communication. I was thrilled. And I don't think I quite had a plan. I mean, I did think I would go back home, which in many ways I have, because now I have a life in both places. But I didn't really have a firm idea of what I would do with it. I was just so grateful to have classes that I actually not only did well in, but enjoyed.
Your character has several hair crises in your novel, Americana. And initially she has to travel to another city to have her hair braided. There's pressure to straighten her hair. She straightens her hair and her whole scalp blisters. Her hair starts to fall out around the temples. She says she grew up in the shadow of her mother's hair. Was hair an issue for you when you came to the U.S.?
Hair is an issue for me. It's an ongoing issue for me. And I quite like the expression hair crisis. It wasn't really when I came, but it became an issue for me. I grew up, in Nigeria, I had my hair braided often, but really what I aspired to was straight hair. And
To straight hair?
Oh, yes.
Why? Yeah. Well, what were the images you saw that made you want straight hair?
Because everybody around me had straight hair.
In Nigeria?
Because the norm is the rite of passage from girl to woman is when you can go get a relaxer and have your hair straight. So I remember looking forward very much to my last day of secondary school, because that's when I could. I remember actually the last day of secondary school, graduating from secondary school, then what I really wanted to do was go straight to the hair salon and get my relaxer so my hair would be straight. And then I came to the U.S. And really, it started off because I couldn't afford to get a relaxer at a hair salon here, because I thought it was just needlessly expensive. So I went to the drugstore and bought the relaxer kit and decided to do it myself, which didn't end well. And having then a scalp with really bad burns, I suddenly thought, why am I even doing this? Why? You know, it's sort of a moment where my scalp is burning and I'm thinking, why do I need to put terrible, horrible chemicals to get my hair to do what it wasn't intended to do? And that's when I stopped using relaxers. But it did take a while for me to come around to sort of accepting my hair the way that it grows from my head. And I think also the idea that mainstream culture tells us that what's beautiful is something that I think for many Black women, I think for me, I should speak for myself really, that when I first stopped using relaxers, I felt very self-conscious because I realized that the way my hair was as it grew from my head didn't match what mainstream sort of society said was beautiful. So I then sort of went through a period when I would overcompensate by wearing big earrings because I wanted to still sort of make sure that I was feminine, right? Even though I don't have the long hair, and even though my head is standing on my head rather than falling down, I'm still female. So here are the big earrings.
What kind of hair did your mother have? Did she straighten it?
Yes. All her friends did. It was the norm. My mother made history in Nigeria. She was the first woman who was registrar of the University of Nigeria. She's brilliant. She's... But yeah, and I think my mother still doesn't like my hair natural now. She really would just rather have me have a relaxer.
I just find that so interesting, because like in the 60s when afros became popular, it was so important to so many people to have a kind of natural hair and to not process it in any way. And it was in some ways an Afrocentric statement too. And so to hear you talking about growing up in Nigeria, where you and your mother straightened your hair, I presume to look more Western.
Yeah, but you know, I suppose so, yes. I mean, I don't think that women in Nigeria were consciously aware. I mean, I don't suppose that they sat down and thought, now we shall try to look white. I think it's just that there's a larger idea of what's beautiful that people just absorb and internalize. And, you know, these are women, my mother's generation, my mother's class, my mother's friends, were all women who were educated. So when you think about it, my mother went to missionary school. She went to university. And when you think about what ideas did she receive about what's beautiful? And I don't think it's that surprising, really, that they would then go on to somehow associate beauty with straightened hair and the hair that grows on our head the way it is as something that one has to do something about. It's actually an expression my mother still uses. She'll say to me, you need to do something about your hair.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people have mothers who've said that to them. I think when you're a mother, you're taught to say that. Chimamanda Adichie will be back in the second half of the show. Her new novel is called Americana. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Citgo, offering tri-clean gasoline designed to keep fuel injectors and intake valves clean while minimizing emissions. More at fuelinggood.com. From Anti Records, featuring Mavis Staples, reunited with Wilco's Jeff Tweedy for the new studio album, One True Vine, available now. And from Dignity Health, healthcare with a commitment to human kindness and a belief in the healing power of humanity at HelloHumanKindness.org. This is NPR.
Coming up, Chimamanda Adichie talks about growing up in Nigeria after the Biafran War and describes the devastating effect the war had on her family. Also, David Edelstein reviews new movies by Pedro Almodovar and Neil Jordan. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with novelist Chimamanda Adichie. Her new novel, Americana, is based on her experiences coming of age in Nigeria, then moving to the U.S. to attend college. There's a lot of observations in the book about race and what it was like as an African-American to learn what it means to be black in America. Adichie's 2006 novel, Half of a Yellow Sun, is about the Biafran War. You were born in a town called Nsukka, am I saying that right?
Nsukka. So the N is hummed.
Yes, Nsukka. And that's the place where the University of Nigeria is.
Yes.
Your parents were both affiliated with the university. Growing up in Nigeria, race obviously wasn't the defining trait of who your friend or who your enemy was or the history of conflict or anything, but ethnic identity really mattered a lot. Your family is Igbo, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the Biafran War, your town was a part of the breakaway state of Biafra, but it was captured early in the war by Nigerian forces. So what did that war mean in the life of your family?
My family was deeply affected by it. I like to say that my parents' generation lost their innocence in that war. My father lost everything he owned, every material thing he owned. He also lost his father, who died in a refugee camp. My mother lost her father. My parents had just come back from the US months before the war started. My father was eager to get his degree and go back to Nigeria because he was part of that generation who very much wanted to build up their countries. And he gets back to Nigeria. He starts teaching at the University of Nigeria. And then months later, this war starts. And he tells just so many moving stories, many of which I used in my second novel. And I think the memory is still very much there for him and for his generation. When I started researching the novel that set around that period, I realized that talking to them was really when they would tell me about it was the first time that they had actually really talked about many of the things that happened. And my father tells a story about his father dying in a refugee camp. And his father was a titled man in Igbo land, which meant that, you know, he was a great man. He had one of the highest titles that a man could have. But his hometown fell, so he had to leave and go to a refugee camp, and he died, and he was buried in a mass grave, which, you know, is just heartbreaking for a man, particularly a man like him. And my father, who's the first son and who takes his responsibilities very seriously, very much wanted, he couldn't go to bury his father because the roads were occupied. He was in a different part of Biafra. And so it took a year until the war ended. Then he could go to the refugee camp. And he says the first thing he wanted to do when the war ended was go to the refugee camp. And he goes there and he says, you know, I want to know where my father was buried. And he said somebody waved very vaguely and said, oh, we buried the people there. So it was a mass grave because so many people had died. And my father says that he went there and he took a handful of sand. And he says he's kept the sand ever since. And for me, that was one of the most moving things that I'd ever heard. And it said so much to me about my father, who's such a lovely, gentle, quiet, stoic man. And I didn't realize, I don't know, I just hadn't imagined that my father would be a man to take a handful of sand and to keep it, and what that meant and the symbolism of it. And also, I think that story just says so much about what the war did to them, not just in the way that they lost material things, but in the way that they lost emotionally.
In your book, the main character's mother in Nigeria converts to evangelical Christianity, converts from Catholicism. And when she's born again, she burns all of her Catholic objects. Is that based on a real story?
Yes. I think many Nigerians will probably find that familiar. There's a growing Pentecostal, Christian Pentecostalism is growing in Nigeria. It's been growing, I think, for the past 20 years. So I grew up in a Catholic family, very moderate Catholic. And growing up, I realized that slowly people were leaving the Catholic Church, and there were expressions like, it's a dead church, and there's a lot of devil worshipping and that sort of thing. And so I have a relative who left the Catholic Church, and I found it very interesting that what he did, the first thing he did to show that he was making this break from the Catholic Church and was going to join a Pentecostal church was that he gathered all his rosaries and all of his Sunday missals, and he burnt them.
That's really quite a statement.
I thought it was, and I was quite young, but I was very much struck by it. So I've actually used that, which is why I use a version of that story in my book, because it's, you know, there's something, it's also quite powerful and makes one think about how, you know, because I think that for him, being Catholic meant that he had invested a lot of his faith in those objects. And I think it was his way of saying, that's it, I'm not doing the rosary and the scapula and the miraculous medal and that sort of thing. And yeah, it's interesting that Nigeria now is full. Nigeria is very religious, extremely religious. and on both sides. So it's very religious in the north with Islam. It's very religious in the south with Christianity. But what's interesting is that the version of Christianity now is very Pentecostal, very very prosperity preaching, and for me also quite strange and troubling.
Again, a kind of comparison between the U.S. and Nigeria, where you're from. I think there's a lot of African Americans who want to absorb a certain amount of traditional African religion into their life, whatever, you know, that religion of choice is. But at the same time, in Africa, so many people have been converted to, you know, Pentecostalism or another form of evangelical Christianity, or even like the Mormon faith. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's just an interesting contrast.
It is. But I suppose, again, just thinking about also how education came to Africa and to West Africa.
You mean like through missionaries?
Yes, that education came with missionaries brought education, so that it wasn't just education, it was religion. So both came hand in hand. So that for my father, for example, who was born in 1932 and who started to go to school in Eastern Nigeria in 1936, you didn't just go to learn math and English and science. You also learned that Jesus was Lord and that everything your parents were doing at home was evil and demonic and all of that. And so now we have a generation of educated Africans who are also very Christianized. Not only Christianized, though, because I think it's possible to be Christianized and still have a certain respect for other traditions, but many of them don't, because the version of Christianity they got was one in which to be Christian meant not only to reject, but to demonize traditional religion. So many people in my father's generation think that what their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers did was, you know, evil, or they use interesting words like heathen and pagan and that sort of thing, and they're very negative associations. And so it is interesting. I, for example, wish that I had been taught a bit more about Igbo traditional religion. I, the little that I know about it seems to me to have been a very accepting, open, and quite beautiful way of looking at the world.
Does religion, any religion, have a place in your life now, if that's not too personal to ask?
I don't know.
Is that you don't know if it's too personal, or you don't know if it does?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah. I do feel ambivalent because I'm very interested in religion. When I was growing up, I grew up Catholic, and my family was moderate. My father, who's still very much a devoted Catholic, was very kind and also very open to my asking questions. And I was a child who endlessly asked questions. And I should also say that when I was growing up, there was often a divide between the Catholics and the Anglicans. Not the Pentecostalism. Now, these are the two that are more Orthodox denominations, but still. So children would have these fights in the playgrounds about Catholic versus Anglican. And I was always the spokesperson for the Catholic side. And because I was also fairly good at talking about things I knew nothing about, I would speak very, very forcefully for Catholicism. So we always won the argument. And maybe my interest in religion has become a lot more, I don't know if political is the right word. So I'm a lot more interested in how religion shapes the way people make choices that affect their lives, the way people will vote for a certain thing or person because of religion, and also how religion can be such a good force in people's lives. I've seen people who have faith and for whom it's just brought a lot of meaning and hope, and you know, and I also respect that. So and it's impossible to engage with Nigeria, which is a country I love very much, without engaging with religion. It's just impossible.
Can you give us an example of how you would defend the Catholic faith to your Anglican friends when you were a kid?
Yes, absolutely. So they would. So we were often accused of worshipping the Blessed Virgin. And so I would then sort of go on and on about, you don't know the difference between honoring and worshipping. We honor her because she's the mother of Christ, but we don't worship her. What we worship is the Blessed Trinity. Right. And these poor kids would think, oh, my Lord, she's probably right because she she seems to be making sense. And then I would selectively read the Bible so that I would only get the bits that I felt supported Catholic teaching. And I should note that I was about 10 when this was going on. And so I still have memories. I still have some of them in my head. And so if the Anglicans would make fun of us about the anointing of the sick, which is one of the sacraments in Catholicism, I would then quote from a passage from the letter of St. James, I think, which goes, "Is anyone sick among you? Let him bring in the priests of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith shall save the sick man, and the Lord shall raise him up. And if he be in sin, they shall be forgiven." So if you're 10 and you have your playmate reciting this in support of Catholicism, I think you would sort of very easily give up. So it worked out quite well for the Catholic group. And some of my friends and I still talk about it and laugh.
My guest is Chimamanda Adichie, author of the new novel Americana. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Chimamanda Adichie, and her new novel is called Americana, and it's about a young woman who moves from Nigeria to the U.S. to go to college. There's a scene in your novel where the woman who later moves to America to go to college, she has a boyfriend. They've had premarital sex, and she has what turns out to be appendicitis, but she thinks she's pregnant. And it terrifies her. And so the question of abortion comes up, and the question of birth control comes up. And the boyfriend's mother tries to tell them, like, you should wait. You should really wait before having sex. But if you do have sex, you have to take responsibility for it. You should have condoms. You should be prepared. And I wonder if there was anybody in your life who could give you that kind of talk.
There wasn't. I wish there had been. I think part of the reason that character, Zobinza's mother in the novel, is actually, I think, my favorite character in the novel. And also, I think she embodies all of the things I love and admire in women. And my mother was fairly, I should say my mother was fairly liberal in the sense that I had many friends who couldn't have boyfriends openly. So they had to sort of sneak around and they couldn't go to parties, so they would come to my house and change into their little dresses or shorts or tight clothes or something before going to a party because they couldn't dress that way from home. And in my family, my mother made it very clear that if I had a boyfriend, she wanted to know who it was, he could come visit at home and that sort of thing, which was unusual, actually. Because something else about that generation is that there's an incredible sense of conservatism about sexuality, particularly about girls' sexuality. So the people in my mother's generation don't much mind if their sons have girlfriends. That's fine. They don't care. But the girls having boyfriends, no way. I mean, there's just a... And of course, you know, when it's time for marriage, you're supposed to bring the perfect man home and nobody wonders where the heck you're supposed to meet him. But I wish that I had had somebody like Obinza's mother who would just be very blunt and open about sexuality, about acknowledging that young people are interested in such things, and just, you know, and talking to people about birth control. And but she's unusual, and many Nigerian readers have actually talked to me about her. Some women have said, we wish Obinza's mother had been our mother.
So did you experience culture shock sexually when coming to the United States?
No, I don't think, you know, I sometimes, it seems to me that America is often seen to be much more sexually liberal than it actually is. I think, when I go to Holland, that's where I experience sexual, where somebody will say, oh, when I was 13, I was having sex and my parents knew, and I'm thinking, what? Right? But I don't think that's necessarily the case in the US. So not really. In fact, what I quite liked, actually, when I came to the US was the idea that a boy and a girl could be friends and nobody and people didn't automatically assume that there was a lot more going on, which is the case in Nigeria. So you're just friends with a boy, and it's very hard for people to understand the idea of a friendship between male and female that has nothing to do with sex or sexuality. And I found that in the US that this was not the case, and I quite like that.
I'd like you to explain the title of your book, Americana. You might spell it for us first. And tell us if you feel like you are perceived as being an Americana, or if you see yourself that way.
So Americana, which is America, and then with two extra letters, A and H at the end, it's actually a Nigerian word. So it's a kind of playful word that's used for people who have been to the U.S. and who come back to Nigeria with American affectations, or who go to the U.S. and come back and pretend that they no longer understand Igbo or Yoruba or Hausa, and or who come back to Nigeria from the U.S. and suddenly won't eat Nigerian food, and everything is about when I was in America. And also often it's used for people who are genuinely Americanized, but it's a very playful way of, it's often used in the context of a kind of gentle mockery. And I don't think of myself as Americana. I think partly because I was fortunate enough to go back to Nigeria after only 4 years in the U.S., unlike some people who just can't get to go back. Like the character in the novel, she doesn't go back for 13 years. And when she goes back, she's really changed. And Nigeria has also changed. But I went back after 4 years. And even then, it had changed. But there are times when my friends tease me about such things as going to a restaurant in Lagos and ordering steamed vegetables.
Is that so weird?
Because they say to me, so sometimes when we're getting there at the restaurant, and my friend Choma, who's this lovely woman who lives in Lagos, and she'll turn to me and say, "Do not ask for steamed vegetables today. They don't do steamed vegetables. That is an American thing." And because, vegetables are often drenched in oil or the, sort something. And I did have my phase of slightly American eating issues when I would sort of say, "I don't want any oil," or I would say things like, "What kind of oil is that?" And then my friends would say, "Please just stop being so American." Or when I would complain about people smoking in public places, and they would just shake their heads and say, "How American." So little things of that sort. But I think that in general, but on the other hand, some of my cousins are very disappointed at my still remaining resolutely Nigerian. So when I go to my ancestral hometown, I don't speak a word of English. I will speak only Igbo. And my cousins are so disappointed, particularly that I don't have an American accent. They're very unhappy about that.
Okay. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chimamanda Adichie is the author of the new novel, Americana. Her last name is spelled A-D-I-C-H-I-E. You can read an excerpt of Americana on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews a new comedy from Pedro Almodovar and a new vampire film from Neil Jordan. This is Fresh Air. Two acknowledged masters of the cinema have movies opening this week, Spanish director Pedro Almodovar and Irish director Neil Jordan. Almodovar's I'm So Excited is an ensemble comedy set on an airplane with mechanical problems. And Jordan's Byzantium, which is in theaters and also available on demand, centers on a pair of traveling English vampires. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The decade of the 1980s, when major corporations made their presence more felt in Hollywood, was for all kinds of reasons a low point in American moviegoing. But two beacons abroad, Pedro Almodovar and Neil Jordan, reminded us, with movies like Law of Desire, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, and Mona Lisa, how films could be personal and still reach a large, or large-ish, audience. 30 years later, we have Almodovar's I'm So Excited and Jordan's Byzantium, and these directors are still shining a light. In recent interviews, Almodovar, ironically, laments the passing of the 80s, but for reasons unique to Spain. General Franco, with his institutionalized fascism, was dead, still dead, as Chevy Chase used to say, and there was an explosion of hedonistic art. But Almodovar thinks his country has become more culturally repressive, which is his underlying theme in his comedy I'm So Excited. The movie is about how over-controlled people act out and become truly themselves when crisis hits. The crisis is in a plane that departs Madrid from Mexico City. The landing gear has been compromised thanks to a mishap involving two very famous actors who've appeared in other Almodovar films. I won't spoil it. As the plane circles for hours in preparation for a hard landing, three flamboyantly gay male flight attendants drug the, quote, savages in economy class to keep them calm and then slam down tequilas. In First Class, an ensemble of very witty performers, many frequent Almodovar collaborators, gradually let their dirty laundry hang out. The characters we follow are a star actor, some newlyweds, a possible hitman, and most memorably, Cecilia Roth as an ex-porn performer and Lola Dueñas as a virginal psychic with her eye on a hunky sleeping passenger. One pilot is very possibly gay, but closeted. The other says he's, quote, hetero, but unhappily married. In a delightfully convoluted sequence, the famous actor makes contact, his phone calls somehow tied into the plane's PA system, with two ex-girlfriends on the ground, one suicidal, the other played by Blanca Suarez, who's finally broken free of his spell. Those convolutions are what keep you laughing, and eventually as high as that plane, blissed out by the Candyland colors and the music by Alberto Iglesias that mixes melodramatic strings like something out of the old disaster movie Airport and a noodling clarinet. That campiness is full of emotion. Almodovar is so fluid that he doesn't seem to make movies anymore, only to dream them aloud. The Irish fabulist Neil Jordan is equally on top of his game. 2 decades after his uneven interview with a vampire, he's back with Bloodsuckers, this time female, in Byzantium. Saoirse Ronan plays Eleanor, a young-looking but very old nomadic vampire who travels with her Cockney guardian Clara, played by Gemma Arterton. Clara is bent on secrecy, on keeping the pair's rapacious private lives private. But Eleanor feels a deep need to tell her story to the world. She tries only to drink the blood of the sick and elderly, who receive her gratefully as an angel of deliverance, as in an early scene with Barry Casson as an old man.
There comes a time in life when secrets should be told. You've got secrets, haven't you? There was a story told when I was a boy about the Niav Morav, the revenants. Neither dead nor alive. The priests used to tell it to frighten us.
My name is Eleanor Webb.
Eleanor Webb, I am ready.
Are you sure?
I spent quite enough time here, believe me.
teenage Saoirse Ronan makes the perfect vampire, her face as austere as a death mask, but her incandescent blue-gray eyes signaling the soul beneath. Jordan and writer Moira Buffini weave stories within stories. Every vampire has a tale to tell. An extended excerpt seen on TV from an old Hammer film, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, clues you into the movie's revisionist theme. In that picture, monks hammer an enormous stake through the heart of a writhing, nightgown-clad female vampire, an obvious metaphor for women being punished for carnal desire. But the females in Byzantium assert their right to indulge. The movie is gorgeous, poetic, the lyricism actually heightened by harsh jets of gore. As usual in Neil Jordan's films, romanticism wins the day, or the night, which might be unsatisfying to some horror fans hoping for a blowout climactic bloodbath. But for most of us, these female vampires bestow the kiss of life.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. We're closing with music from the soundtrack of I'm So Excited, composed by Alberto Iglesias, who has written music for several of Almodovar's movies. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Riverhead, publisher of the new novel And the Mountains Echoed by Khalid Hosseini, about finding a lost piece of yourself in someone else. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science, technology, and economics in the modern world. And from Arizona State University Online, more than 60 undergraduate and graduate online degree programs at radio.asu.edu. This is NPR.
Take good care of my baby.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview with Carol King. Anne will listen to her demo recordings of her early songs. Last month, she received the Gershwin Prize for Popular Song from the Library of Congress during a performance at the White House paying tribute to her songs. Join us.